Today, what I'm going to do is that talk about conformal symmetry and conformal field theories. Of course, it's a very broad subject, which deserves like a course of full semester and so on. But I won't really try to give you the complete picture about conformal field theories. Instead, I will just give you some general flavors, like what is this conformal symmetry and what is conformal field theories. And in particular, we will try to say some of the consequence of conformal symmetry in the example of this transverse Ising model, or more generally, quantum critical point or critical point in classical system. Okay, so one thing I guess you have learned is that that usually at a critical point there will be what we call a scaling invariance, meaning that the system will behave the same if you look at a different scale, right? So I believe you have learned that in the course of stack Mac. And one consequence of the scaling symmetry is, for example, if you compute correlation functions, for example, in this transverse Ising model, again, I'm using a convention that, let's say, my Hamiltonian of transverse Ising model is like this. So if you compute the correlation functions, for example, two-point correlators, you will get a power law decay correlation functions. Here I'm considering the case that in the thermodynamic limit, meaning that the system size is infinitely large. So then I will get this power law correlation and with a universal power. And this power is what we called scaling dimensions. And for 2D Ising, it's known exactly that is 1/8. So and you can also compute correlators of other operators like this Z operators, and you will get some power. And again, so that is really just a consequence of scale invariance, right? And from the perspective of RG, it's very natural to expect that you get a scale invariance, right, at those phase transitions, right? Remember that if you consider RG process that for any system, then you kind of coarse grain your system, like you look at how the system is behave as I change the length scale, right? Eventually, you want to reach some fixed point, right? Which is doesn't change as I vary the length scale, and that is nothing but I get a scale invariance, right? So that means, so in other words, it's very natural that at a fixed point we get a scaling symmetry, right? So and what's fascinating about this story is that very often this scaling symmetry actually get enhanced to what we call a conformal symmetry. And just in case that you haven't heard much about conformal symmetry is a symmetry transformation that preserves angles. So you can call it like angle preserving transformations, right? So you just imagine that you can kind of distort your space, but meanwhile you maintain the angles of any two lines and so on. That is what we call conformal symmetry, and formally speaking, you can try to let's say, write conformal transformations as what we called a transformation that deform your metric, right? Because with the metric, then you can define the distance, you can define the angle of any curves, right? And so in other words, so we can consider a conformal transformation as something that I deform my metric that, let's say, I deform it to just some space-dependent functions times a normal metric, right? Here I'm just choosing a metric of flat space, right? So then for this, so this this say x can be some space-dependent functions. That's why it can kind of distort your lattice, your space. But since it doesn't, it's just like deform your space. It doesn't change. It's still proportional to delta mu nu. That means that if you really still, if you want to compute angles and so on, it will not be changed, right? That is how you think of conformal transformations. So for the conformal symmetry story in those critical point is that those critical point will be invariant on the transformations that in this manner that deforms your metric, right? So you can kind of think this metric deformation as some non-uniform scale transformation, right? At different point of your space, you scale your system in a different way, right? And the point dependence of your scale is really just this encoded in this function, say x, right? So then from and then similar as this perspective of RG, right? So then you can think that a conformal symmetry is like an enhanced version of this idea, right? At a fixed point, you get scale in symmetry. Then you can say that if the system is invariant under some non-uniform RG, right? If it is invariant under non-uniform RG, then you can say that the system is conformal invariant, right? That is a physical interpretation of what is conformal symmetry. Why do you expect that at those fixed point you get a conformal symmetry? All right. So and we can be more concrete about what are those conformal transformations are, right? So again, we are going to use this definition of conformal transformation, and then what we can do is that, let's say we just perform a transformation, an infinitesimal transformation to my coordinates. Such that, let's say, it transforms x mu. It just, right? So suppose that I have such infinitesimal transformation, and then I want to check that how does the metric transform under this infinitesimal transformation, right? So we can easily work it out. So you just the Jacobian times my original metric. My original metric here is really just delta alpha beta, right? So then you can work out that, let's say, what's the change of the metric. And you will find that it's actually, because epsilon is an infinitesimal number, so then you can just keep the lowest order. And with one or two lines of algebra, you can get that the transformation of my metric. It just looks like this. And now, using the definition of the conformal transformation, that means that it should equal to Cx times delta mu nu, right? So that is the equation. And now the goal is that to solve that, what choice of this epsilon can make this equation hold. And this equation is actually called conformal Killing equation. So and now you can solve this equation and then get what are the infinitesimal transformations of conformal transformation. And then let me just tell you the result. It's actually pretty easy to understand most of those results. There's a special case if you consider a two-dimensional system like this 1 plus 1 de-icing, but that's start with just a generic dimensions. So let's say a generic D. Right. So there are indeed four different types of solutions. The first solution is simply that epsilon mu, epsilon is a constant, right? And you can easily verify that if epsilon is a constant, then this conformal Killing equation is satisfied trivially, right? And where the Cx is just zero, right? And you can easily recognize that for this solution, it's nothing but translation, right? Right, and yeah, of course we know that if you perform a translation, it doesn't change the angle, right? So, and the second solution is taking this form, epsilon mu equals to x nu times omega mu nu, and this omega is a anti-symmetric tensor, meaning that if you exchange mu nu, you will get minus sign, right? And you can also easily verify that this equation, this solution is satisfied, and again, trivially, in the sense that Cx still equals to zero, right? And indeed, you can realize that this transformation is nothing but a rotation, right? So it is rotation. Again, yeah, we understand that if you perform a rotation, it doesn't change angle, right? So the third solution is that is epsilon mu equals to lambda times x mu, right? Again, you just insert this into conformal Killing equation. You can easily verify it's correspond to that say x equals to 2 lambda, yeah, and then you can you know that that's nothing but the scale transformation, right? And sometimes we call this as dilatation. So all those three solutions are indeed something we already know, right? And what's really special is what we call the special conformal transformation, whose solution is epsilon mu equals to 2 times the inner product of A and X, and X mu minus X squared A mu. And this A is some arbitrary vector. So you can choose any vector A and define such transformation. And then you can find that this conformal Killing equation still hold, where the Cx equals to the inner product of A and X, right? And it's you can try to do this as a homework that show that it satisfies the conformal Killing equation. And as I said, this transformation is what we called special conformal transformation. Or SCT. And one, and you can, so those are the infinitesimal transformations. You can also work out what are the finite version of it, right? The only non-trivial part is the is this special conformal transformation, and its finite transformation is looks like again it's SCT, but its finite version will be. Pretty complicated looking. So the denominator is 1 minus 2 times the inner product of A and X, and A square, X square over X mu minus A mu X square. Right. It's really a very complicated looking transformation. I myself can never remember it. Precisely, but so then that's yeah. So it's really a funny, interesting story that this the generically at a critical point the system is invariant under this funny looking transformations. Yeah, that's the beauty of this conformal symmetry story. But follow follow this line of reasoning, you kind of. Expect that maybe it's a generic thing because you can really view the conformal symmetry as a symmetry that invariant under this non-uniform inhomogeneous RG process, right? So that's the story for generic dimension. And as I said, if you consider two dimensions. Indeed, you do get a very special solutions. That is really a special property of 2D. Indeed, in 2D, the solution of this conformal Killing equation it has infinite number of solutions, and this can be best the same by you introduce a complex variable, let's say this z is x1 plus I x2, and z bar is x1 minus x2. And then you can use a lot of technologies of complex analysis and then find the solutions to study the conformal symmetry. And it turns out that indeed it's also very easy to check that is any transformation defined by the analytical function of z is conformal. Is conformal if fz is analytical, right? Right. So you can easily verify that, and then you can find that, for example, if you consider this the measure, and you will find that it's actually just transforms to the derivative of this fz times the new matrix, right? And that is and just telling us that it's it's a conformal transformation, right? Yeah. So that's really a special properties of in 2D, and of course you can write down explicitly. So you can so for analytical functions you can just expand it using the powers of z, right? Like constant, zeros power, first power, second power, and so on, right? And indeed, you can verify that. I write it twice. You can verify that. For example, the translation is. You don't need that. The translation and a rotation correspond to that, the first power, and then the special conformal transformation actually correspond to z squared. And for all the higher power of z, that's the new conformal transformations, which is special in 2D. So yeah, that is the what does this conformal transformation look like? And So the next, I will use those conformal transformations to derive some properties of conformal field theories, and in particular, how does it apply to the, for example, 1 plus 1, the eigentransitions. What are the consequences of that? So I can pause a little bit if there is any question.
What exactly do you mean by non-uniform RGA process?
Yes. Good. In usual, for example, if you consider the block spin scheme, right? What you do is that you choose several spins and then you block them together, and make a super spin and then do this RG, right? So then in that process, you always fix, like, let's say I just block four spins together, right, everywhere. Right. But now what you can do is that let's try to do some non-uniform version of that. Let's say at some place I block four spins, at some place I block eight spins, at some place I block two spins, and so on. Right. And then the conformal symmetry is indicating that under this, the fixed point is also invariant under this kind of non-uniform RG. If you have continuum, then you can even do a more smoother version of that, this non-uniform RG transformations.
But how exactly is that related to the conformal symmetry, the fact that you can do different block sizes?
Yeah, so just to look at this definition, right? You deform the metric, right, in a manner of a space coordinate dependent. If it is not, if it is coordinate independent, that's nothing but a scale transformation, right? Yeah. But now I allow that I kind of rescale my space or metric non-uniformly at different coordinates. Right. That's conformal transformation.
And just a question,
yeah.
Number three there, the dilation, that would be like uniform scale.
Yeah. All right, so we have derived the infinitesimal conformal transformations, and then what we can do is that we can write down the generators of my conformal transformation. And one thing I would like to remark is that indeed conformal symmetry forms a group, which is, for generic case, for generic dimension, not for 2D, is the symmetry group is SOD plus 1, comma 1. And yeah, that indeed is a Lorentz symmetry in the D plus 1. D plus two dimensions, like the Lorentz symmetry of the two dimensional higher. Yeah, that's the conformal symmetry group. And you can, now you, that what we want to do is that to write down the generators corresponding to each conformal transformations. And of course, those generators are the generator of this conformal group. So again, for the first one, translation, that's something we are very familiar with. That's nothing but partial mu, and usually we call it as p mu. And the second one is rotation. What we will call it is m mu nu. And we know it's an anti-symmetric tensor, and it equals to, it can be defined as x mu times partial mu minus x nu partial mu, right? That is the generator for rotation. That's what we learned in the past. And for dilatation, it's we usually call it as capital D, and it will be x mu times x mu, right? So, and the last one, this SCT, will be, and we usually call it as k mu, and it will be 2x mu times x nu partial nu minus x squared partial mu. Right, that's the conformal generators, the four conformal generators. And then with those generators, what you can do is that we can compute their commutators, right? That's the usual way that we define the algebra, right, of a group, of a Lie group. And there are multiple commutation relations. Here I'm going to there are a few very important. I will not write down all the commutation relations. Instead, I will write a few very important commutation relations. The first, the first thing that you can show is that the translation actually commutes with the dilatation, right? And intuitively, it's easy to understand it, right? Because yeah, if you rotate it and translate and then rescale it, it's commute with the other way around. You can also directly show it just by using those generators. And the other relation is a commutator between the dilatation and translation. So if you do if you compute the commutation between this, and then you find that it actually just goes back to p mu. And very similarly, is minus, if you consider it for SCT, it's minus. Yeah. So these two relations actually are very important for later applications. And if you consider the commutations with translation and SCT, you will get 2 delta mu nu times d minus 2 m mu nu, right? Yeah. So those are the important commutation relations that are useful for the later discussion. Guess here you already kind of say that this translation and SCT is like raising and lowering operators for this dilatation. Okay, so that is the conformal generators and their algebra. Now let's say how we what are the consequences of those of this conformal symmetry in our physical systems like this 1+1D Ising transitions. So is there any question at the moment? Okay, yeah, actually, one thing I probably didn't emphasize enough is that so far we are actually working in the Euclidean space, right? For example, it corresponds to that you consider a 2D classical Ising transition or 3D classical Ising transitions. So and now we want to go to the quantum case that corresponds to our example is transverse Ising model, quantum Ising model, and then we need to perform what we call a Weyl transformation. So let me be more concrete. So let's say generically, we can start with this Euclidean flat space, right? So physically, you can think it as some classical Ising transitions, for example, on a flat space, right? And then we can one thing you can do is that now I'm picking one point as an origin, and then I start to draw spheres. In my space, right? You just right. So for any space, you can choose to do that, and then this sphere will be SD to the minus one, right? And then you can kind of understand what are those transformations and some of those transformations are doing on this sphere, right? For example, then the rotation symmetry are really just a rotation symmetry of my sphere, right? And the dilatation is really just I rescale the radius of my sphere, right? Then you can say the dilatation just acts in this radial direction, right? So you can also write down its metric. It's nothing but dr squared plus r squared times dn squared, right? This n just is the unit angle of this sphere. Okay, that's my metric. Okay, and as I said, let me actually say it later. So okay, so that is the classical system that's it's conformally invariant, What we are going to do is that we apply what we call a Weyl transformation. we apply this transformation that is I preserve, and this n doesn't change, right? The sphere doesn't change, but I'm doing a transformation on the radius, right? And that actually goes to the what we call the quantum case SD minus one times R, and that is a quantum case. And usually we call it cylinder geometry. And and this becomes this time direction, and this R is really just a time direction which comes from this transformation. And this at each time slice, I will get SD minus one. Right. So that is the this quantum case, right? Back to the transverse Ising model, right? Remember that we are studying a quantum spin chain, right? And that corresponds, I mean, that there's a 2D system, a 1 plus 1D, right? Then that's really just that at each time slice, you have a quantum system defined on this circle, right? That's the transverse Ising model we study, right? And this horizontal direction is a time direction. That's how you relate it with the classical case. Okay, and the theory will be invariant under the Weyl transformation. So you might be wondering that this Weyl transformation doesn't fall into the conformal solutions, right? We have just got, but you can indeed show that actually this Weyl transformation also satisfies our original definition that I just rescale my metric, rescale my metric. And the way to say it is now you just work out the metric on this cylinder geometry. It equals to d tau square plus r square times dn square, and it equals to r square, capital R square over small r square, and times the metric of flat space. Right, it's a very straightforward work it out by just using this relation. Right. Now you see that indeed this Weyl transformation also just rescale my metric. Right, but it's not captured by the previous derivation, because previously we just assumed that this transformation, there's an infinitesimal version of that transformation, right? But Weyl transformation doesn't have an infinitesimal version. It's like a large conformal transformation. Precisely people call it Weyl transformation because it can even change the curvature of your space. Usually those conformal transformations here will not change your curvature, right? So, but the key is that under this Weyl transformation, it's simply again that it just rescale my metric, right? So then the system the theory will be invariant under this Weyl transformation, and then we can just using the conformal symmetry to say what is the consequence of the conformal symmetry in the quantum case, which directly applies to the transverse Ising model we studied, right? Remember that just for the transverse Ising model case, I'm just define my quantum spin chain on this time slice, and then, yeah, that's it. So, and you can easily, I mean, there are a few things you can easily work out. One thing is that if you consider a dilatation, let's say in here that I just rescale my radius to the exponential lambda times r, right? And that corresponds to the dilatation, right? And ask what does the dilatation look like in the quantum case, right? It's very easy to say that because, yeah, here I'm taking a log of radius to get the tau, and then under this dilatation, then it's really just I shift my tau, right, with capital R times lambda. By the way, the capital R is really just the radius of my circle in this case, right? So, in a quantum system, the operator that shifts your time, right, is nothing but Hamiltonian, right? So in other words, this dilatation in the classical case becomes my Hamiltonian in the quantum case. There's an actual factor R times Hamiltonian, and this R is really just comes from the way that we define the time in the quantum case. And it also corresponds to the system size, right? Like the radius of my sphere in the quantum case, right?
Sorry, what does the RH stand for?
H is Hamiltonian. Okay. Yeah, R is the radius.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is that evolution under imaginary time evolution or real time evolution?
Both.
Both, okay.
Yeah. So shoot. H is my Hamiltonian. R is the system size. So as you see, now in this side, the dilatation really just becomes my Hamiltonian. Now you can kind of see the importance of those two commutations I highlighted before. Now that really becomes the commutation relations involving Hamiltonians, right? Then that has very sharp consequence on my energy spectrums or eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Yeah. So we can let's work out the consequence of those algebra or conformal algebra, right? The first thing that we should notice is that the dilatation commutes with my rotation, right? And in the quantum case, it's also very simple, right? Simply because my quantum Hamiltonian defines on this s to the d minus 1 has a rotation symmetry, right? Then that means my every eigenstate should have well-defined angular momentum of my rotation. And then, and then you can label your eigenstate with the energies, with their energies and their angular momentum, right? Now let's look at the commutation relations. Of this dilatation and translation, right? On the in the quantum side, I have this I times R times H. If you do the commutator with the translation, as I said, you will get P mu, and if you do K mu, you will get minus K mu, right? So now let's say I have a state, I have an eigenstate of my Hamiltonian whose eigenvalue, whose energy equals to E0. E0 is just my ground state energy, right? Because when you write down a Hamiltonian, you can arbitrarily add a constant to it, right? That will lead to some change in the ground state energy. It's not a universal thing. The energy gap is universal. And this eigenstate has an energy that is E0 plus delta over R, right? The reason that the gap is proportional to 1 over R is is a feature of those critical points. Remember in last lecture that we have computed the ground state and the excited state, where you can find that the energy gap will be proportional to 1 over L, right, for all those low-lying state, right? And here, you kind of also say that here, the dilatation becomes R times H, right? The dilatation really just tells you its eigenvalues will be some scaling dimensions, right? Scaling dimension just corresponds to how the operator changes under the scale transformations, right? And here it translated to R times H. That's why you end up with then the energy will be delta over R, right? Okay, so now we can do, we can ask, what if I apply a P mu to this eigenstate? In the quantum case, P mu actually becomes an abstract operator, which has nothing to do with the translation of my spin chain or any quantum mechanical system on this sphere, right? This, even for 1 plus 1D, the translation actually becomes the rotation symmetries, like along becomes the rotation symmetry, right? Yeah. So, and that is manifest in this Hamiltonian, and that rotation corresponds to the generate M mu nu, not the translation here. Here, the translation is really just an abstract operator. So now we apply this P mu to my eigenstate and ask, and you can easily show that actually this P mu phi is also an eigenstate of my Hamiltonian simply from this relation, right? And you can find that its eigenvalues will be, its energy gap will be delta plus 1 over R, right? Right. So it's a very simple algebra you can show. And then it tells us that by applying this, the P mu is really a generator that can generate a new eigenstate with a larger energies, and the energy it generated is precisely 1 over R, right? So that means, yeah, if you look at the energy spectrums, it should have a very rigid structure as long as you have a state with this energy gap, delta over R, then you can find a state with energy delta plus 1 over R, and you can keep on generating eigenstate with that with P mu. And similarly, if you ask what happens if I apply SCT K mu to my eigenstate, what would I get? Again, you get an eigenstate but now the eigen energy will be lower because the commutation relation, right? Then here the P and K are really the raising and lowering operators of my eigen energies, right? And then so for arbitrary state, you can just start to applying this SCT generators, right? Yeah, each time you apply this SCT, you lower its energies. But we know that for Hamiltonian, like transversizing or any local Hamiltonian, its energy should be lower bounded, right? So that means you cannot keep on doing it, right? You cannot get infinite number of eigenstates by applying K mu. At some point, when I apply this relations, applying K mu, I should get zero, right? I cannot generate any state beyond some energy, And that means there exists a state which will be annihilated by the by k mu, right? For example, ground state would for sure be annihilated by k mu because there's no other state who has low energy, right? And indeed, there are infinite number of such states which would be annihilated by k mu. And those states are called primary state. The primary state is defined by the state that is annihilated by this SAT translation, sorry, SAT generators, and then for any primary state, what you can do is that you apply p mu, then it will generate infinite number of states, right, with higher energy, and those state are what we called descendant state, and schematically you can write it as just applying a bunch of p mu to it, and then you get infinite number of state, right? And the energy of low state will be equals to again, my ground state energy plus delta phi plus n over r, right? That's their energy, right? So again, this is simply just a relation that comes from here, right? So and this is the so with this, then we know that for any system, for any critical Hamiltonian, which has conformal symmetry, then its energy eigenspectrum should precisely follow this relation, right? Let's say I have a state with, so first of all, I can among those low-lying states, there are like many conformal primaries. Those primaries will be annihilated by the SAT generators, and then I can apply the translation generators to generate infinite number of descendants, and in particular, the energies of those descendants will have very rigid relation with the energy of my primary state, right? There, if you rescale your energy spectrum, let's say times it then by R, and then you will say that the energy levels between primary and descendant are just integer spaced, right? The rescaled energy, right? That is the really a very sharp consequence of the conformal symmetry. And you can also alternatively, you can also say that just that my energy spectrum forms a representation of my conformal symmetry group, and that's just another way to rephrase this structure. Okay. Yeah.
Ask. Is there a direct? Maybe I missed this. A direct parallel between the primary state and the ground state?
Yeah, ground state is a primary.
It is.
Yeah, it's a very special primary.
Okay, but there are other primary states.
Yeah.
So primary states includes ground state, but not limited to ground state.
Right. Indeed, ground state, so for ground state, it annihilated by the k, and also it annihilated by p. So it doesn't have any descendant. But for other primaries, they will have descendant. This delta is really just scaling dimensions, right? As I have explained. Let me give you. Actually, I can use. So let me give you some examples, like what are the primary state in the transverse Ising model, right? So yeah, one thing that is about this. So as you can guess, right here, this delta is really just the scaling dimensions, right? Because they are indeed the eigenvalues of the corresponding to the eigenvalues you get by performing scale transformations on this side, right? That's why they are scaling dimensions, and those scaling dimensions are nothing but those guys, right? Which gives you the power law correlation functions. So, and for 2D Ising CFT, or in other words, there's a correspondence between those eigenstate, let's say state, particularly those primary state, with the, maybe I should write here, right? So there's a correspondence between the operators, let's say operators here, and those operators are just the operators with the power law correlation functions. For example, if you compute their correlators, you will get a power law correlation functions with a universal power, this delta, right? And those operators will just correspond to the state phi. On this side, this is called a state operator correspondence. And then the energies of those phis will correspond to the scaling dimensions of the operators, right? And for 2D Ising CFT, there are two very special primaries. One is called a sigma operator. It's a Z2 odd operator. And the other is what we called epsilon. And it's a Z2 even operator. And in terms of spin language, those sigmas are really just my xi operators, right, on a lattice. And this epsilon is really just the zi operators on the lattice of my transverse Ising chain, right? And we know that the scaling dimensions of this sigma will be 1/8, and the scaling dimension of epsilon will be 1. That's from the exact solution of the Ising. We know that. You can also, now you know the exact solution of transverse Ising model. Indeed, one thing you can try to do is to evaluate the correlation functions of x and z, then to find that it really follow the power law and with this universal power. But with this conformal symmetry, we can do something indeed much simpler, right? Those operator will correspond to excited state in my eigenspectrums of my Hamiltonian, right? And if you look at, I guess you guys have, last lecture I've talked about how to compute the ground state and also excited state. I think in tutorial you also have some problems that relate to that, right? So if you look at low-lying spectrums of this excited state of transverse Ising, right? The first excited state, is a Z to odd state. Remember, in this Jordan-Wigner transformation language, that's really just the state, the ground state with a different boundary conditions than the ground state, right? The true ground state is an antiperiodic boundary state of the complex fermions, Jordan-Wigner fermions, and then the first excited state will be the periodic boundary state of the complex fermions, right? So you can compute the first energy, excited energies, it will be some numbers, right, over L. L is your system size. Here you can simply relate, L is really just proportional to my radius of my sphere or circle, right? And you can also compute the second excited state of your system, and that is indeed in the Z2 even sector. That's in Majorana fermion, sorry, in Jordan-Wiener fermion language that correspond to you create some actual fermion in the BCIS wave functions, right? And similarly, let's call it E2, and then you can compute its energy gap. Again, it will be proportional to 1 over L. And then one thing, indeed, you can verify it, is that the energy gap of the second excited state will be 8 times of the first excited state. Yeah, that's nothing but the relation of this. Yeah, the scaling dimensions of those two operators. Yeah. And then indeed, you can try to compute a lot of excited state of the transverse Ising model. And then after rescale them, for example, you can just rescale your energies such that you make the first excited state have the energy precisely 1/8. And then you can, the rest of energies will be just scaling dimensions of different operators. Then you can indeed see this structure, right? This primary and descendant structures, right? So yeah, and that is the consequence of the conformal symmetry on this 1 plus 1 D critical chain. The final remark I would like to make is that here I'm just playing with a global conformal. I'm just playing with a conformal symmetry for generic dimensions, right? As I said, in 1 plus 1D, right, there are indeed more solutions for the conformal transformations, right? And those for those solutions, you can also define generators, and those are called Virasoro generators. And then the story is very similar to those generators P and K, but you get a bunch of more generators, and then they are more complicated, slightly more complicated algebra you can play with, which turns out to be very, very powerful. And with those, you can actually exact solve the 2D Ising's CFT's spectrum and many other properties, right? But the idea is very similar, that you really just work out the make use of the commutation relations. And then you can view those generators as some state generating operators. You just apply the generator to your primary state, then you get a bunch of descendants, and then the scaling dimensions and energies are completely fixed by the commutation relations. Right. Yeah. So I think I can end up here.
Is it easy to get the expressions of B, mu, and K, mu, the operators that are applying the quantum state?
Yeah. So the expression of P mu and K mu in this quantum spin chain case will correspond to something like let's say P mu plus K mu will be something like the Fourier mode of my Hamiltonian. Something like this. This Hj is really just something like this. That's the.
You just mentioned these other operators for the 1 plus 1D and then solving exactly the spectrum. But I guess my question is, what is the point of these more complicated? Is it just another way to solve the problem? Because I mean, it seems like it's pretty solved with these operators.
Because you don't, with this conformal symmetry, you don't know what are the scaling dimensions, right? Here, I'm just telling you the answer.
Uh-huh.
Right? And one thing is that here, indeed, there are infinite number of primaries under K mu. Here, I'm just giving you the two lowest one.
Okay.
Yeah. But in the context of 2D CFT, those two primaries are very special. They're also the so-called Virasoro primary. So yeah, let me say a little bit. Those are called Virasoro primary. Because in 2D, because there's infinite number of conformal transformations, you can define the Virasoro generators, which we called Ln, Ln bar, with n to be integers running from minus infinity to plus infinity. And that's really, remember that for 2D, the conformal transformation is really just, let's say you can think it as z goes to the power of nth power of z. Each power actually give you two conformal generators. Mm-hmm. And then you can work out their relations, commutation relations, and so on. Those are called Virasoro algebra. And then for those usual conformal transformations that correspond to L0, L plus 1, minus 1. Yeah. And then there's a special concept called Virasoro primary, meaning that if you apply any conformal Virasoro generator with n larger than 0, the conformal the Virasoro primary is a state annihilated by any L n larger than 0. Right? That's a much stronger relation, right? Compared to the usual primary, right? The usual primary is really just L1, right?
Okay.
Equals to 0, right? In 2D, you get those actual relations, and turns out that those two primaries also are indeed Virasoro primaries,
right?
And you get a finite number of primaries, and then you can solve it, right? But if you just use those usual conformal transformations, you get infinite number of primaries.
I see.
That's very hard to solve.
I see.
Sorry, could you just repeat in general what the relation is between the number of primaries and the number of generators that you have?
There's no general relations. It just, go ahead.
You said that those two, the sigma and epsilon, were also Virasoro primary.
Yeah, yeah.
And hence you can constrain the spectrum with just those, is that right?
So the usual story of those Virasoro symmetries, that let's say the Ising, 2D Ising, is that once you realize there's a Virasoro symmetry, right, you can define those Virasoro primary. And after you do that, then you find that only finite number of Virasoro primary.
Okay, okay.
But that's not necessarily true for other 2D CFTs. There are indeed other 2D CFTs with infinite number of Virasoro primaries. And if that's the case, then you probably need to find some new symmetries. Otherwise, you cannot solve it exactly. Yeah, indeed. Right now, there are still a large number of 2D CFTs, which we don't know the exact solution. Yeah, it's called irrational CFTs. Yeah.
Also, could you once again explain where this expression came from for P mu plus K mu?
Oh, that comes from the stress tensor.
Okay.
So you know, for any quantum field theory, you can write down a stress tensor, right? And then indeed, for all those conformal generators, you can rewrite it using stress tensors.
Right.
Yeah, and then that's how you get this expression. The Hamiltonian is actually is one component of stress tensor, right? That's what we know from quantum field theory, right? And then from that you can get this relation. Yeah, it's something that is not well known, I would say so.